Revelation 6 chapter, down about verse 9, says that when he broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word. Would you care to comment on that related to
why don't you repeat that question? I don't know if anybody can. His question had to do with Revelation 6, verse 9, where John there sees the souls of the martyrs, and there they are underneath the throne, if I recall, and they are asking for their blood to be avenged. And I believe these are two separate visions. They are seen from two different perspectives. In Revelation 6 and verse 9, that to this point, the blood has not been avenged because time has not been declared no more. They have not been able to go on to their final reward. But yet, in a sense, I believe that they do live and reign with Christ in the intermediate state. And I believe that is the picture that we're given in Revelation 20. To where, in one sense, they still look forward to a final reward. The comfort is given in Revelation 20 to comfort those Christians that are giving the faithful service at that time, being persecuted heavily and even dying, that they are comforted. They are living and reigning with Christ right now. But the final avenging of their blood has not yet occurred.
Colin Bonfay?
Some of the writers, Jim, take the position that the first resurrection in Revelation 20 is a resurrection of the cause of these martyrs. And in chapter 6, they are seen under the throne crying, "O Lord, how long?" In Revelation 20, they are now on the throne because their cause for which they died has been resurrected. And that, of course, they apply then to when the Catholic Church was overthrown and the Bible was given free course in the world. Why did you reject that?
Well, for a couple of reasons. John sees the souls of those that have been killed for the gospel, and I believe that we should understand from that testimony that he is not seeing the souls of individuals on the earth. He is seeing the souls of those that have already passed to the intermediate state, and therefore I don't believe that people still on the earth are being dealt with here. So the question we have to ask is, who is living and reigning with Christ? Is it the martyrs that are living and reigning with Christ, or is it people on the earth living and reigning with Christ because the spirit of the martyrs have been revived? And there's a little bit of, actually two different views there that people take. I don't know which position you're taking there. If in the position that it's referring to Christians on the earth living and reigning with Christ through the martyrs, then I would say that that doesn't fit the context of the word souls. If you're dealing more with the martyrs themselves reigning, is that what you're...
Well, I'm not real sure what position I think
okay.
is. I asked the question. No, what I have understood is that in Revelation 6, these are the same souls that you have in Revelation 20, but that because of events that have happened on earth, the perspective has changed. In Revelation 6, the things going on earth at that time are that the Catholic Church is in control, the true church is being persecuted bitterly and is suffering terribly. And these who have died for the witness of Jesus, these martyrs, are crying out in the intermediate state, "O Lord, how long?" Whereas Revelation 20, I had thought, pictures a later time on earth when their cause for which they died, the same martyrs in chapter 6 that had died, has been resurrected. And that cause is the cause of truth, because the Word of God now has free course.
The martyrs here are said to reign during the 1,000 years. And so to take that position, we'd have to say the 1,000 years is something other than the entire gospel age.
Right. I don't think it's discussing the beginning of Christ's reign. I think it's discussing the beginning of the reign of the saints with him.
So you think at that point then Satan was bound?
Right. See, I think that Christ's kingdom established on Pentecost, we all agree about that.
Right.
But what I'm saying, saying is that the time the saints began to reign with him was when the Word of God once again had free course in the world.
Right.
And that that is a long indefinite period, like you said.
So the millennial age actually began at that point rather than at the ministry of Christ.
Well, that's what I had thought. But
right. I believe that's the position that J.T. Hines takes in his commentary. I believe, as the scriptures noted in Matthew 12 and other passages, that the millennial age, it seems that Satan was bound during Jesus' ministry.
Well, I don't want to dominate things. I don't see any reason why Matthew 12 has to be connected to Revelation 20 at all. I realize the same figure of Satan's binding is
right.
used there, but I don't see that the figure has to apply to the same thing at all. I don't understand why that has to be that way.
Right.
See what I mean?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm not sure it exactly has to be that way, but I think the language is very similar. Another thing is the two interpretations then you have of the Greek word azeison in verses 4 and 5. I believe Hines takes the position that the second resurrection then of what he calls the second resurrection in verse 5 is the bodily resurrection of all men. And that is the very same Greek word used there, and it seems that the context at least doesn't indicate that he is dealing with two different resurrections. I believe if it's taken in its proper context, what is actually saying is John is saying one group does this while the other group doesn't. And that he's not dealing with the bodily resurrection there at all, is the way I understand the passage. But I do understand what you're saying, and I did read what Hines had to say.
Ray Fox?
Very good, Jimmy. Very composed, your presentation. Well, the lights go out and everything, just keep on. let's see, a couple questions. Do you know of any passage in the New Testament that describes the intermediate state of the dead as a resurrection?
No, I do not, except when Jesus was talking about, got some notes here on that. When Jesus was talking in Luke 20, verses 37 and 38, I believe he dealt with,
where's that up, please?
Luke 20, verses 37 and 38. Verse 38, actually. Here he deals with the existence of Abraham and I'm going to have to read the passage here.
Let me just read it out loud from 34 to 38.
Begin with verse 32, last of all the woman died also. Therefore in the resurrection, whose wife of them is she? For seven had her to wife. Jesus answering said unto them, the children of this world marry and are given in marriage, that they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given to marriage. And as I understand the word resurrection here in verse 37, now that the dead are raised, even Moses showed at the bush when he called to the Lord God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto them. Now, if understood that these individuals here, God saying he is the God of the living, are alive, the word here used is the same form of the word the Zason, as is used in Revelation 20, I recall. In determining, in calling it a resurrection, It's never specifically called a resurrection. Of course, that's the principal problem with the interpretation that I took, is to try to make it fit the figure of a resurrection. Looking at it this way, though, we might say that the righteous go on from life in this earth to an existence, and not just an existence, but actually a life with Christ, living with Christ. The physical life on this earth comes to an end, and a new life in the spirit world begins. They live with Christ, to where the unrighteous dead, though they exist, they do not live with Christ. It's a different kind of existence that they have. And in that sense, I think it fits the figure of a resurrection, that the physical life comes to an end and they go on to a new kind of life. I don't know if that answers your question very well.
Maybe one short comment on that. That we may be confusing the word living with the word resurrection, because right. Resurrection is an enlivening, a quickening, like we say sometimes. And there's no doubt that those, the souls of the righteous dead, including Moses and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they continue to live, but as whether or not there was some quickening of them is another question. That would be applied to their body. The body would be resurrected. Right. One other question on this second sheet. Smith, can I see the second? Let's see. No, I think it's the first one. Never mind.
Certain.
I don't know which one it is. It says,
well, we only got one more.
Yeah, there it is right there. It says, the language is such that those who participate in the first resurrection do not participate in the second. The indication is that those who participate in the first have no need to participate in the second. Right here, I have a problem with that, with the logic there, because just because he says that, let's see, going back to Revelation 20, just because he says, but the rest of the dead live not again until the 1,000 years were finished, does not necessarily indicate that the righteous would not participate in the second resurrection. In other words, in verse 5, he could very well be talking about, parenthetically talking about the fact that the unbelievers will not participate in this first resurrection, whatever it will have, but they will participate in the second. In other words, in verse 5, he's just talking about the unbelievers, the unrighteous. So what I'm saying is, when John says, but the rest of the dead live not again till the 1,000 years were finished, that doesn't necessarily indicate, as you have it there, that the righteous will not participate in the second.
I think it forces the language an awful lot to make it otherwise. Seems to me the clearer rendering would be, we have one group in verse 4, and verse 5 deals with the remainder. And it's a parenthetical thought, as Paul has told the Christians, that the righteous living will go and live and reign with Christ, and then just parenthetically, in regard to those that are not righteous, they don't live and reign with Christ.
Right, I would agree with that. But when you say, therefore, this indicates that those who participate in the first will not participate in the second, is actually forcing a logic. But we can discuss it later.
Okay.
Ben Sayers.
Appreciate the thought very much, and I definitely have a problem with calling the first resurrection a resurrection of the cross, for the reason that Christ said, that upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And if there's a resurrection of the cross, then there must have been a revelation prevailing over that cause for it to die and be buried. Mm-hmm. I do not think it ever was.
Good point.
So we must from my point of thinking in that, we've got to find some other first resurrection. And why do we not accept the resurrection of Christ and those that was resurrected at the time he was, or after he was, right at that time? Why can we not accept that as the first resurrection at the beginning of the millennium?
In verse 4, that those that participate in the first resurrection are described as those that were killed or martyred because of their testimony of Christ. Those that did not receive the mark of the beast or worship him. I have trouble considering, first of all, the resurrection of Christ or those that were resurrected with Christ at his crucifixion or at his resurrection, whichever the case, however you interpret that. I have trouble seeing how they fit that particular figure, how they could be martyrs for the cause of Christ before Christ did, and they apparently died before Christ did, and before Christ ever died. I have trouble seeing how they could be martyrs for the testimony of Christ before Christ himself ever was crucified and resurrected.
Well, one thing I might make in that connection. Before Christ died, the Apostle Peter rejected even knowing him at least 3 times because he feared that he might be slain because he knew him. And we don't have any idea how many might have been slain because they knew him. You see, just a thought.
Alan Bailey.
I guess I've been called worse than Orville wants to turn.
Yeah, he's down here. I got him down here.
Jim, why in verse 4 are there, why do you see two groups of people? I didn't catch that. You said there were two groups, those beheaded for the witness of Jesus and those who had not worshipped the beast. Why can't that be the same group?
It very easily can be. It's very possible that he's dealing strictly with martyrs. And it's possible, too, some see as many as 3 different groups of people. That they see one group at the beginning of verse 4 is those that were sitting on the thrones. Yeah. And then the martyrs is a second group.
Well, maybe I misunderstood. It seems to me, if your view is correct, you have to see two groups there.
You have to see two groups. Yeah.
If it's the same group, I think it fits the first cause deal better because it's the martyrs who had not worshipped the beast, which is the Catholic Church, if you accept the historical view.
Yeah, that's a possible interpretation. I don't deny that.
Orally.
Yes, if I understood your position right, you didn't have the devil loose and deceiving nations at all through the gospel age. And it seems to me like that's what the whole fight and everything was about in the book of Revelation, that it was in that all of this took place in the gospel age. In fact, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ. And so it's all pertaining to Christianity. The killing of the martyrs, the deceiving of the nations by Satan through Roman Catholicism, and then his being bound when that power was thwarted, when freedom of religion came back to people at the close of the Dark Ages. That's when it, but it appears by you taking the position that it all happened in the gospel, that Satan was bound throughout the gospel age, that you have a problem there of having him bound throughout the gospel age, because he had to be loose and deceive some nations for him to be bound, for that power to be bound of his deceiving the nations. And it was through Roman Catholicism that nations were deceived in the masses.
Well, so are you taking the position now that Satan is loosed, or is he bound today?
He's bound at this time, but he's just about loose, I think.
I understand what you're saying. That's a historical interpretation, historical amillennialism, what I call the historical interpretation of the passage.
forgot what I was going to say about it. Satan, you're saying that he was loosed at one point and then he was bound, and what bound him?
I'm saying when the Roman Catholic religion started,
that he was loose.
That Satan really got loose in that era of time, and that's when the martyrs were killed for their upholding Christianity.
And then he was bound when the spirit of those martyrs revived. And
yeah,
were able
when those martyrs, the cause that they died for was resurrected to its rightful place.
And they were
live and reign in our minds and appreciation for what they did back there.
So what you have is you have a period in which, as Vance pointed out, you have a period in which Satan was able to overcome the kingdom of Christ.
No, he never overcame the kingdom, but he did fight it because it's on record. He fought it, he killed it, he hurt it, but he never did prevail against it because they overcame, and that's what the book is about. And when they're resurrected to the throne, that's where they won the fight. That's what they won out, and they were resurrected.
I understand what you're saying, and I think that's a viable interpretation. I don't think it's necessarily correct, but I may say that.
You might ought to meet John T. Hines again, because it takes a lot of courage for anybody to really attack John T. Hines' general view, because he's just about the best that there is on it. There might be a place or two that, or even more than that, on technical points that you might could differ with. But he would be pretty hard, if you read his book again, he'd be pretty hard to attack.
Any more questions or comments?
Let me...
I'll let Taylor then.
Actually, John T. Hines borrowed from B.W. Johnson, who borrowed from Barnes. I don't know who Barnes borrowed from, except for their views on premillennialism. They pretty well track the same historical events in the book of Revelation. You don't see a correspondence between Revelations 20 and John the 5th chapter then. In John 5 and verse 25, there is a resurrection mentioned, which undoubtedly is the individual conversion of a person. The hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. In verse 28, he talks about a different resurrection, a resurrection of the body of the dead. But you don't see a correspondence between this and Revelation 20, I
presume. No, I do not. Not at this point anyway. I do believe that baptism fits the figure of a resurrection, but I have trouble fitting that into the context of Revelation 4 and 5. And I think Raymond's going to explain that verse further to me, so I may just...
Just a comment on what Taylor mentioned there. I was reading Hendrickson the other day with reference to my talk. And Hendrickson is a thoroughgoing Calvinist, of course. And he takes that very view that you mentioned. If baptism is the first resurrection, the second death hath no power over them, eternal security.
Right.
And I can't accept that at all.
Yeah, I think that's a very small problem. That there are other passages of Scripture that we have to deal with.
If the Christian age, the binding of Satan is the Christian age, what is the little season in verse 4 when he's going to be loose for a little while?
Well, this is just personal theory and accepted as such, but it seems that in the passages that I go to say that Satan is bound through the ministry of Jesus or between that point and his resurrection, each of those passages deal with in some way the extending of the kingdom of Christ or the preaching of the gospel. And I would go from there to say it's the preaching of the gospel then that's what keeps Satan bound. And therefore, Satan being loosed for a season would seem to indicate there will be a period of time in which society will deteriorate to a point that at least the gospel will not be preached effectively. And that will just be a little season, and at that point Christ will come again and call time to an end. But that's just a personal theory. Not that all Christians will vanish from the earth, but there will be a time that the gospel is not preached effectively on the earth.
Orville.
I'd like to clarify one point on Matthew 16, 18, where Jesus said, I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. That just because the devil attacked martyrs, that wouldn't be that really what Matthew 16, 18 is talking about. Christ said, I'm going to build my church and the gates of hell are not going to prevent me from doing it. And it didn't prevent him from doing it. He built it. He rose from the grave, conquered death, and he built it. Just like you say, I'm going to town and nobody's going to prevail against it. Jesus said, I will build my church and the gates of hell, the gates of Hades, shall not prevail against it. Death itself, and even though my spirit goes in the Hadean realm, that will not prevail against me building my church. I'll rise from the grave and build my, and my church will be built in spite of death and in spite of Hades. The gates of hell shall not prevail against me building my church. And it didn't. He built it.
In regards to that little season, I think there's some explanation there in that very same chapter, verse 9. Verse 8 and 9. When 1,000 years have expired, Satan shall be loosed, loosed out of his prison, shall go out and deceive the nations which are in the quarters of the earth. Gog Magog, together them together from the battle, the number of whom is the sand of the sea. They went upon the breadth of the earth and passed the camp of the saints about the beloved city. Fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. So it seems like if there's going to be a little season right there just before Satan is destroyed, that the church is going to appear to be enslaved.
Now, I think that correlates with the great battle in Revelation 19 as well. I think that's... I figured Orville had something to say about that.
Well, it's not the Gog and the Magog, a symbol of atheistic communism, which is prevalent in the world today and threatened all the nations of the world and attacking Christianity and attacking the church. Isn't that what's taking place? Don't we see it developing in the world today, the devil getting loose in that manner? And Gog and Magog would have the only thing that came out of that portion of the world that would have anything to do with spirituality or Christianity would be atheistic communism, and that theory, and it has gone rampant throughout the world today, even in our country, and it's going to the four quarters of the earth, and the devil's getting loose, isn't he?
Well, that's not the subject of my topic, so...
you talked about Revelation, the 20th chapter, and you talked about... You talked about the thousand year reign,
right?
And so Satan being loose is involved in that too, so that was part of your
problem.
That's
not
the
principal part.
Yeah, Jimmy, I just had a question about your reference to Luke dealing with those disciples that were casting out demons, also in correlation with what was mentioned in Mark 16. About casting out demons. Is there a possibility of a synonymous view of the destruction of Jerusalem allowing a couple of Old Testament prophecies, Zechariah and Malachi, dealing with that time, that destruction of Jerusalem, and the passing away of miraculous gifts and Satan being bound? Is that view possible, that those two synonymous things took place at the same time?
I really don't know. I didn't consider that at all.
Anyone else? Concluding remarks, briefly. Clovis.
I thought I understood Orville say that the devil's about to get loose.
That's what I heard.
Then I thought I heard him say that he's already loose because it represents atheistic communism. He overlooked Gorbachev's visit over here when he's trying to make peace with everybody. He says it won't work anymore, so it looks like communism might be on its way out. So I don't know what he's about to get loose or what he's already loose or what the deal.
He's going to be bound again.